All right, like I said, we're going to continue. We are going to cover two chapters tonight. Get caught up, chapter 8. And by the way, boy, you know, it was kind of a slow start getting into Zechariah. We actually started late last year, and then we took a break because of the holidays and all the special events that we had on Wednesday nights and the break in the action. And then it was kind of slow getting started, getting into the book. Of course, I love to do the setting. It's important that we know what's going on, why a conversation is being had, and what the subject is, who it's between. So, you know, we get into the history of it a little bit, but now we are really starting to roll. And then beginning next week, when we get into chapters 9 through 14, is where they really get into the heavy prophecy that most people relish in the study of Zechariah. But tonight is an important segue. The book is kind of divided into three parts, chapters 1 through 6, which is just completed, chapters 7 and 8, which is a transition, and then chapters 9 through 14, which will begin. Of course, in review, we remember that the Israelites had been disobedient for much of their time in the Promised Land. And of course, God had sent prophets, God had sent famines, God had sent plagues. God had tried to get their attention in many, many ways. Eventually had to drive them out of the land, just as he said he was going to do. And of course, 70 years in captivity. And then, as Isaiah had prophesied over 100 years earlier, they were allowed to return, and they were released by a king named Cyrus, just as Isaiah had said over 100 years before the event actually happened. The surprising thing is that only about 50,000 Jews returned. Most of them had adjusted to life quite well in Babylon, and they were comfortable there. Business was going well, and even though they weren't in the land of promise, the promise that God had made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their descendants, they were quite happy being in Babylon. Of course, Zerubbabel led this group. Zerubbabel was actually in the lineage of David. He was not a king, although he could have been if Israel had still been autonomous. But Zerubbabel was the governor under Medo-Persian rule. They began immediately with discovering the location of the altar. And they built the altar and reestablished the temple sacrifice. Then they laid the cornerstone for building the temple when, of course, as you know, their construction plans were halted. Their neighbors, mainly the Samaritans that had been their traditional enemies, opposed it politically. And they went through channels and wound up getting this construction progress halted. Now, the thing is that it shouldn't have come to a complete halt. The danger was the walls of the city, basically being the military fortifications of the city. It really shouldn't have been a halt to the building of the temple, but there was. The people went about building their own homes and expanding their own businesses and getting right back into some of the corrupt business practices, which led God to judge them to begin with. But God's work was being ignored, and that went on for about 14 years. And it was for that that God sent these two prophets that were contemporaries to get the people's attention. Of course, Haggai had a very short ministry, literally three sermons over 4 months. And then Zechariah built upon that which Haggai had begun and encouraged the people with messianic promises. Now, again, as I just mentioned, Haggai's ministry is very short, calling them to get back to work, rebuking them for some of their past sins and some of the things they had fallen back into. But Zechariah was, again, an apocalyptic prophet and was given magnificent signs and wonders, which were visions and messages that he conveyed to the Israelites, repeating the fact that God's promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were going to be carried out. Of course, these 10 visions were given over the course of one evening. Talk about a bad night's sleep. This was it. But these 10 messages reaffirmed what we would call the promise of the kingdom of heaven on earth, what the New Testament would refer as the millennial reign of Christ, what the Jews would call the age of the Messiah. Then, of course, last week, as we looked at chapter 6, we saw a love offering being taken in Babylon among the Jews, and sent to help with the reconstruction of the temple. The offering consisted of gold and silver. Zechariah was told to go and take this offering and make several crowns out of it. The silver is representative of the priesthood. Of course, the half a shekel silver was paid annually, the temple tax. There was silver as the means of redemption. Gold was obviously a symbol of royalty. So these together represented the priesthood and the kingly reign, and they were placed on Joshua, the high priest's head, symbolically. Now, Joshua never did rule or reign, so he understood that this was not literal. This was a way of types and images being used in rabbinic Jewish teaching. Zerubbabel also was not crowned, even though he was actually of the proper lineage and would have possibly been the king if not for their being in bondage for 70 years. But he wasn't given the crowns either. The point that was so significant about this is that there was a division between the priesthood and the crown. The seed of David was to sit on the throne, from the tribe of Judah. But the tribe of Levi was to administer the priesthood and also ministry around the temple. And they weren't to be mixed. Of course, we have one story of one king, a good king, Uriah, that attempted to go into the temple and do some of the priestly duties, and God struck him with leprosy. But this king and this priest is a picture of Jesus, who is a high priest, according to Hebrews, after the order of Melchizedek. And we remember this interesting figure that we see in one spot in the book of Genesis, chapter 14, after Abraham had gone off to rescue Lot, that had been taken captive by the Babylonian kings, and he returned. This king of Salem, the king of peace, actually would have been Jerusalem, came out and met him. This king, Melchi, which is my king in Hebrew. Zedek is righteousness. My king of righteousness, the king of peace, who is both a king and a priest, not after the order of Levi, because Levi hadn't been born yet. Abraham was still standing there. Abraham would bear sons Isaac, who would bear son Jacob, who would bear son Levi, and there was the lineage of the priesthood. But Abraham gave tithes and offerings to Melchizedek, proving that Melchizedek was in fact a superior to even Father Abraham. And of course, we know that Jesus is both king and priest and will rule and reign literally in Jerusalem on the throne of his father David during the time that's called the kingdom of heaven on earth. That's not a spiritual kingdom. It is both a spiritual and literal kingdom, a political rule for 1,000 years on planet earth. Now with that, let's pick up in chapter 7 and 8. It came to pass in the fourth year of King Darius. First observation is understand that if you have done your study in the books of Chronicles or the books of Kings, years are always measured in the reign of Jewish kings. But here is a time during the period of the times of the Gentiles. And history is reckoned according to Gentile kings. Fourth year of King Darius. This is about 2 years after the last message. They're about halfway through the reconstruction of the temple, which would take about 4 years total. And the word of the Lord came unto Zechariah in the fourth day of the ninth month, even the month Chislu, which would be approximately our December the 7th, if we were going to compare our time of the year versus this time of the year. When they had sent, who was the they? Well, King James translators actually, I think they missed on this. We're going to see a contrast between this term, house of God, which is Bethel, versus the house of Jehovah Sabaoth in verse 3. So what this was a delegation sent from Bethel, which means house of God. This is where Jacob had his vision, his dream of a ladder ascending up to heaven with angels going up and down on it when he was on his way escaping the wrath of Esau when he first went to begin his time of chastisement at Uncle Laban's house. So this was also a significant place in the history of the northern kingdom. After the division of the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, you remember King Jeroboam, in order to make sure that his people didn't go back to Jerusalem, for the annual holy days, he created two golden calves. He put one up north in the city of Dan and one in the south here in Bethel. So these representatives, this delegation from Bethel, was sent to the priests, which were ministering in Jerusalem as they were doing their sacrifices. The altar had been built, and they were in the process of reconstructing the temple even at that point in time. These men, Sherezer, which is a Babylonian name, as you know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were in fact Babylonian names. Belteshazzar was the name for Daniel in Babylonian. And Regem-Melech and their men came to pray before the Lord. So they made this trip to Jerusalem. And their primary purpose was to speak unto the priests that were functioning there, ministering there at the house of the Lord of hosts, and to the prophet, saying, should we weep in the fifth month? Should we separate ourselves and weep and fast in this time that we have set aside in the fifth month? Well, what are they talking about? Well, even to this day, as you can see on this Jewish website called Chabad.org, the month is Tish Abav. And this is a very important memorial among the Hebrews, and I will tell you why. According to the Jewish calendar, it was on Tish Abav that the spies had returned after surveying the promised land for 40 days, and they returned to Kadesh Barnea and then voted 10-2 not to trust God and go into the promised land. It was that day that God said, I am done with you as a faithless generation. You will wander for 40 years, and your children that you're so concerned of will inherit the promises of the promised land. Interestingly enough, it was also on Tish Abav that the temple was destroyed by the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. Now, that's where history stopped at this point. The Jews, by the way, this wasn't established in the books of Moses. This was just their own tradition. That ought to strike a chord with us as Baptists. We take tradition very seriously, and that's okay. Traditions are fine. However, there's a difference between a biblical mandate and a religious tradition, which the Jews were very guilty of. Now, here's something that's ironic. Later, when the temple was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD, it also was burned on Tish Abav. Later, during the Bar Kokhba revolt in 135, that revolt was put down and he was killed on Tish Abav. And then, of course, this was also a historic date in ancient Europe or in old Europe, medieval Europe, for Jewish persecution. So this was a holy day that the Jews had established where they would set aside and fast. In fact, this particular verse talks about their weeping in the fifth month. From this Jewish website, Chabad.org, it talks about the things that are expected of a proper Jew on Tisha B'Av. No eating or drinking. Do not wear leather footwear. Don't bathe or wash, or washing only until the knuckle when mandated by halakha, which is the walk of your rabbi. Applying ointments or creams. So this is not a good day for odor around the house, I can tell. No washing, no deodorant, no colognes. But this is a sign, this is a day that they held sacred in mourning and still do. So this delegation from Bethel comes to the priests and say, hey, now that we're back in the land, you know, this day commemorated the burning of the temple. Now we're back in the land. We're rebuilding the temple. Do we still have to have this annual day of mourning? Do we still have to have this annual day of fasting? Then came the word of the Lord of hosts unto me, Zechariah, saying, speak unto all the people of the land and to the priests, saying. So here's God giving the message through the prophet Zechariah. When you fasted and mourned in the fifth and seventh month for these 70 years, did you really fast unto me? I mean, even to me? And when you did eat and when you did drink, did you not eat for yourselves and drink for yourselves? So here's what God was pointing out through Zechariah. This so-called religious activity that you're doing, supposedly mourning the destruction of the temple, this wasn't about me at all. This is really about you. You lament your own struggles that you've had to endure for these last 70 years. And when you celebrate these holy days, it's not really about me. You're simply enjoying the holiday. Now, this can strike a chord with us. And we have to be careful. In about a month, we're going to celebrate the resurrection of Jesus. And if we aren't careful, although we go through great pains to try to properly celebrate the Lord's Supper service on Tuesday night of that week, we go through and commemorate, then would somebody go out there and tell them it is time to go? We are having church this evening. This audio will not be worth. Can you all even understand? Hear me? Can you hear me clearly? Okay. I'm doing my best to battle. Sadly, this won't be very well documented in case anybody wants to go back. And I'm interested in our selection of this particular crew, not being aware that we are a church and we have services on Wednesday night. But are we not somewhat guilty of this with some of our Christian holidays? And what I mean is, if we're not careful, Easter can turn into being more about a new dress or an Easter egg hunt, which I am fine with the frivolity. Trust me, I grew up in a home. I got a puppy 1 year for Easter. We got a rabbit 1 year for Easter. I'm all for some of the joys that we have associated with these holy days or holidays. But let's not forget the true emphasis and the focus of what the holy day is all about. And that's what they were guilty of. Christmas. I'm as big a Santa Claus fan as anybody. And we always had fun. My dad had fun with me. When I began questioning, I said, "Dad, when does Santa Claus stop visiting your house?" He says, "When you stop believing." Well, I don't know about you, but I like getting stuff on Christmas morning. So I played the game with Dad. And there was never a confusion in our house between the reality of Jesus and the fun that we had of the Christmas tradition. But we've got to make sure that it doesn't become more about Santa and the exchanging of gifts rather than it is about Jesus and the miraculous birth of our Messiah and Savior. And by the way, I have mourned for the last 3 years for our country. You know, early on, I recognized, and we've documented it. May the 5th, I preached a message in this pulpit called Connecting the Dots. And it was what we had the revelation of COVID, I think in March of that year. By May, I preached the message, and I called this what it was. And what we are in the middle of fighting back against, whether it be the COVID hoax or whether it be an election that was stopped in the middle of the night, which I am 60 years old, I have never seen an election count stopped in the middle of the night. You know, you can explain it away however you want to explain it. All I know is I'm watching the election returns and Trump's ahead by 700,000 votes in Pennsylvania. He's already been given Florida just a few minutes after the polls closed. Things are looking grand. Then all of a sudden, I hear reports of a water line breaking or a basement flooding in Atlanta. Next thing you know, they're stopping the count in four different states. I don't have a logical explanation for that. You can say it was all just a coincidence. Okay. I don't have a logical explanation for that. Then as we've seen over the last couple of weeks, the January 6th insurrection was also a load of garbage. And I don't know, I thought Sunday morning was a perfect illustration. If you weren't here Sunday, you need to go back and watch the message. And you know Pastor Dan, he always likes to have some fun to get started with the messages. And he had that one screenshot, that slide up there, of a Chinese balloon. What did you see after he told you what you were seeing? You saw a Chinese balloon. I saw a Chinese balloon. I didn't question it. When that was planted in my mind and I looked at the screen, I saw a Chinese balloon. Now, if you had just been given that picture, it's likely that you would have looked at it and gone, "Oh, that looks like a bird made a bombing run on that windshield." And that's what it was. But when you plant the thought ahead of time that this is what you're going to see, then we show you a picture, that's what you think you have in fact seen. We've seen, thousands, there's 40,000 hours of video from the Capitol that weren't released for 2 years. Why? Why? If there's nothing to hide, why would they bury it? And of course, we've seen enough about the poster boy of the insurrection, the guy with the horns, supposedly leading this whole thing, and we see video after video after video of him being led around the Capitol, given a personal tour by the security guards. Folks, if we were a Latin American country, and I read about what was going on, I would just shake my head and go, wow, that's too bad. The communists have taken down another one. But this is the United States of America. We happen to be the biggest, baddest boy in world history. And we're not down yet. But we've been knocked down a couple of times. We've gotten back up. And it, quite frankly, right now, it's critical. It could go either way. I'm thankful there's been some pushback. But I want you to know, and I speak honestly about this, in my mourning, I have not just mourned over my country, which I love. I've not just mourned over the fact that we may lose our freedom, although I have mourned over that. I've not mourned over the fact that my children may lose their freedom and my grandchildren may lose their freedom, although I have mourned over all those things and still do to some degree. But the thing that grieves me the most is how this country that was birthed by the pilgrims landing in 1620 in a passionate love affair with Yahweh, how we have so turned our back on God. We are a disgrace. So the reality is, ladies and gentlemen, these things do affect us. And I mourn over the fact that it's going to affect us, but I mourn more so over how we have just unashamedly turned our back on God. Same thing is true here. These people were mourning, but they were mourning over their predicament, over the suffering that they had had to endure, over their hardships. They truly weren't grieved and lamenting over the insult of their God. Now, by the way, if you want something else to take proud of, there's something you can be proud of. The United States of America, the current Surgeon General, some man wearing a dress named Rachel, no, I take that back, I'm not sure what his real name is, but it's something Levine. Richard Levine, thank you. And then this luggage, he used to be a baggage handler at United Airlines, what I understand. Sam Brenton, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Spent Fuel Waste Disposition in the Office of Nuclear Energy. Folks, you know, the Communist Chinese Party is just quaking in their boots when they look at the United States of America right now. We've become a joke. And although it grieves me as a patriot, it shames me as a Christian. Because this has happened on our watch. I'm 60. Go back 60 years ago. Where were we as a country? We weren't here. I guarantee you, if a boy went into the girls' locker room, he got either beat up or beaten by the vice principal. Now he's defended. And if you don't approve of it, you are blacklisted. Zechariah. Should ye not hear the words which the Lord cried by the former prophets, the past prophets, the prophets of our history? When? When Jerusalem was still inhabited, when we were still at a time of prosperity, when our cities of Judah and all around were still inhabited, and even the plains of the coast and the plains around the River Jordan were occupied by people. Back in those days, before we had faced judgment, remember what the prophets said. Now, this goes back to our study of Jeremiah, because this is the specific chief instigator, prophet, that lived in that period of time. And remember the charges that God gave to Isaiah, to Jeremiah and to the other prophets as they were, as God was condemning the behavior of Israel. Here are the spiritual things that they were guilty of. Now, by the way, I ask our pastors this in our pastor boot camps to drive home the point. Which of these would you consider a spiritual issue versus which you would consider to be part of the material world? They were dishonest in business. You would probably consider that material. Doubtless your pastor, other than this church, ever preached against it. You know, God called that out specifically as a spiritual sin. Because what takes place here with these fingers begins here. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, body, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. They ignored the sabbatical year of release. This also was an economic sin, stealing from their fellow man. They used unjust weights and measures, inflation, stealing. They removed landmarks, stealing land. They bribed judges, stealing justice. Their leaders fed off the flock rather than caring and pastoring their flocks. They were disrespectful to parents and elders. They didn't care for their own families. They lived for revelry and drunken parties. They murdered their children. Religion became a big business. They no longer were ashamed of immorality. They even celebrated homosexuality and paraded and reveled in their debauchery. Things that common sense and God said were evil, they called good. Things that experience and common sense and God called good, they called evil. They were proud and arrogant. Their court system became corrupt. Their government was corrupt. They denied and abandoned God. Let me just ask you a question. Am I talking about Judah or the United States of America? Well, actually, this is about Judah. Because every one of these, I can take you to chapter and verse in the Old Testament prophets. However, we are also guilty of every one of these in our country. However, when Jeremiah said, judgment is coming, the Jews responded by, what do you mean? We're God's people. Look, there's his house. God lives right here in the middle of us. What do you mean judgment's coming? God's not unhappy with us. Otherwise, he wouldn't live here. Folks, you've heard me say, and we're going to see it again in these two chapters. That's the point of these two chapters. God is not impressed with how pretty we look on Sunday mornings. God wants to see your faith the other 6 days a week. 168 hours of the week should demonstrate that Jesus is the Lord of your life. That's why this is another verse we introduced to pastors that apparently have never read it. For pastors to say, oh, I only preach the gospel. Really? Well, you know what? The Bible tells us that we are to be evangelists and we also are to protect our flocks. Did you protect your flock during the COVID pandemic? Are you protecting them now in a potential economic collapse? Are you going to be protecting your flock when the banks fail and nobody can feed themselves? No, that's a material thing. That's not spiritual. And teachers, disciples, teaching them to observe all things I have commanded you, even unto the end of the age. And folks, you are a part of this church, so you've got part of the right answer. But you understand why we are in the condition we are in? We have got 350,000 churches in America. How many so-called Christians in America actually follow Christ or have been discipled to follow Christ? Let me give you an answer to that. I called a well-respected Christian statistician. If I said his name, you would know his name. He asked me not to share this about his credit because he didn't actually have the time to do everything he puts into an analysis. This was simply us talking and him doing a back-of-the-envelope mathematical calculation. Said there are 325 million people in America, 255 million adults. I said, how many in America are actually being discipled in their churches in a comprehensive biblical worldview? In other words, how many would you say are 24/7 Christians? 255 million adults, 325 million people. Do I have any guesses? How many would you say? 10%. 10%, that'd be 30 million. Less than 3 million. Less than 3 million. You want to know why we're in the predicament we're in right now? Where's the salt? Hey, we go to church. Boy, we can go to church. We can do church better than anybody. Where's the salt? Where's the light? Oh, we don't mix we only talk about spiritual things. We only preach the gospel. Really? Well, so did the Apostle Paul. But you notice everything that Paul addressed in his epistles? He talked about Jesus of Nazareth being the promised Messiah. And he could prove that in the Old Testament. I hope that this congregation can. Most pastors of New Testament churches can't even find the Old Testament. Proper government. Taxes. Proper sexuality. Sexual sin. Homosexual sin. Marriage. Circumcision. Church discipline. Work and work ethic. Integrity as business owners. Charity. Church organization. Care for widows and orphans. Handling disputes. Pride, humility, and forgiveness. Gossip. Cultural issues of the day. Dress, hairstyles, clean and unclean food, proper doctrine, and yes, eschatology. So the modern preacher that says, oh, we don't talk about those things. We only preach the apostle. We only preach the gospel. Well, why don't you follow the example of the guy you profess to follow? But all you can find in your Bible is the first 8 chapters of 1 Corinthians 15. Wow, there's a whole lot more there. If only somebody would look. Verse 8, and the Lord, word of the Lord came again unto Zechariah, saying, thus speaketh Jehovah Sabaoth, the Lord of armies, saying, here's what I want from you. When you're dealing with each other, now that you're back in the land, and by the way, remember the list that I gave you, that I showed you a minute ago, the sins of Judah. Here's what I want you to do. I'm not concerned with how pretty you look on Sundays. I want you to execute true judgment. I want you to show mercy and compassions, every man to his brother. Don't oppress those that have an uphill struggle. Don't oppress the widow or the orphan. Don't take advantage of the stranger. Don't take advantage of the poor. And let none of you imagine evil against his brother in your heart. What does that mean? Everything begins here in your core. You can come up with a sinful thought or action here, and then it comes out here. So what? Take every thought captive is a great way of putting it. By the way, what did Jesus say when he was questioned by the lawyer about what is the greatest of the 613? What is the greatest commandment? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, body, soul, and oomph. And love your neighbor as yourself. The second is like unto it. By the way, those are the two tables of the law. First 5 commandments deal with our relationship with the Lord. The second 5 deal with our relationship to man. Now, notice another prophet who was a couple hundred years ahead of Zechariah. This was before the city of Jerusalem was judged. Here's what Micah says. When asked the question, how are we supposed to worship? How are we supposed to do church? Wherewith shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings? With 1-year-old calves? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams or with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression and the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Micah says, he has showed me, O descendant of Adam, here's what is good and here's what the Lord expects out of you. Do the right thing. Demonstrate mercy to one another. And walk humbly with thy God. What's that mean? Bible says, how can two walk together unless they be agreed? As followers of Christ, we're supposed to walk with Jesus day by day. Does that mean we're supposed to take off walking and say, hey, Jesus, come with us? No, we're supposed to be following him. Humble yourself and walk with God. And notice verse 11. Shall I count them pure? Okay, they profess that they are followers of Yahweh, but they cheat in business. They use wicked balances. They have a bag full of deceitful weights. For the rich men thereof are full of violence. We're going to look at that word here in just a moment. And the inhabitants thereof have spoken lies, and their tongue is deceitful in their mouth. I got to tell you, I am up to here with people I know in the community or in the state or in the country that on Sundays tweet out a meme of their favorite Bible verse and then are guilty of stealing and lying and gossiping and destroying other people's reputation. Do not call yourself a Christian if all you do is fake it on Sunday mornings. If you're a follower of Christ, just saying, it's got to be 24/7. Some of the instruction we're given, withhold good, do not withhold charity from those to whom it is due. Not everyone is due. Someone is in a situation through no fault of themselves, like that widow, that orphan, person's been fired from his job because he wouldn't take the vax or whatever, then that person is due our love and help. If a person just refuses to work and says, no, I want you to take care of me. Well, Paul said, if you don't work, then you don't eat. By the way, James repeats exactly what we read repeatedly in the Old Testament. The two most underprivileged classes in society, especially in this age, was widows and orphans. Make sure you don't overlook the widows and orphans. Back to verse 11, chapter 7. But they, speaking of those before, during the time of Jeremiah, they refused to hearken. They pulled away their shoulder. They stopped their ears and would not hear. Yea, they hardened their hearts. They made their hearts as an adamant stone, lest they should hear my word, the law, and the words which the Lord of hosts has sent in his spirit by the previous prophets. Therefore I was ticked off, and I came with great wrath, says the Lord of hosts. Therefore it's come to pass that as he cried, they would not hear. Okay? The prophets cried out to the Jews would not hear. So when the Jews were in trouble and they cried out to God, God said, I'm not listening either. And I scattered them with a tornado, a hurricane, a whirlwind among the nations whom they knew not. Thus the land was desolate after them. Israel was desolate. And no man passed through nor returned, for they laid the pleasant land, that's another reference of Israel, desolate. Got this verse out of order. No, I take that back. I can put it in here. Mark Twain, when he did his tour of the world in 1867, wrote a book called Innocents Abroad. Talked about Palestine. Remember, this was the land flowing with milk and honey. This was the land where the 12 spies brought back the grapes from Ishkel that were so large it took two of them to carry one bunch. Mark Twain, 1867, of all the lands there are for dismal scenery, I think Palestine, the British name for Israel at the time, there was no Israel in existence at the time, must be the prince. It is a hopeless, dreary, heartbroken land. Palestine sits in sackcloth and ashes. Over it broods the spell of a curse that has withered its fields and fettered its energies. Palestine is desolate and unlovely, and why should it be otherwise? Can the curse of the deity beautify a land? Now let's continue. We'll just read through. This is largely narrative. I'm going to make some comments, but we will be done early. Verse chapter 8. Again, the word of the Lord of hosts came to me, saying, thus saying Jehovah Sabaoth, the Lord of armies, I was jealous for Zion with great jealousy, and I was jealous for her with great fury. Thus saith the Lord, I have returned unto Zion, and I will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem shall be called a city of truth, and the mountain of the Lord of hosts, the holy mountain. Goes on, verse 4, thus saith the Lord of hosts. By the way, would you say he's speaking figuratively, metaphorically, or literally? Yep, if you're a Jew, you would say this is literal. Only 400 years after Christ's crucifixion did we decide that this wasn't literal, that it was allegorical. Quite frankly, I'll stick with what the Jews thought it said, rather than what Augustine or someone else thought it said. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, there shall yet old men and old women dwell in the streets of Jerusalem. Remember, Jerusalem hadn't been rebuilt yet. Wouldn't be rebuilt until Nehemiah came in 445. They were working on the temple, and they weren't done with it. Every man with his staff in his hand for very age. And the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in the streets thereof. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, it is a marvelous thing in the eyes of the remnant. By the way, it's marvelous in my eyes as well. The city you see in the street, you see in the background, is a popular a shopping area called Ben Yehuda Street. This is over near the Temple Mount. One time, again in the time of Zechariah, this place was desolation. Now it's a thriving city. And this, I hope it's not too loud, this was when we were at the Temple Mount. This is the last time I was over there. Believe it or not, this is like 5 years ago. Can't believe it's been that long. But this was bar mitzvah. A bar mitzvah being celebrated going into the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall. So hold your ears. You're going to see some Jews celebrating for about a minute here. They weren't in the land. There was none of that. The cities were desolate. The land was empty. God said they're going to return. The place is going to be full once again. In fact, it's going to surpass anything you've ever seen. We're in the regathering right now of Ezekiel, the Valley of Dry Bones. We're about to see the next step, the rebirth of Israel during the time of tribulation. And then King Jesus shows up, and it's the millennial reign. Chapter 8, verses 7 and 8. Thus saith the Lord of hosts. Again, notice the military dominant flexing of the muscles. Time after time in Zechariah, it's Jehovah Sabaoth, the Lord of God's armies. Behold, I will save my people from the east country and from the west country, and I will bring them, and they shall dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God in truth and in righteousness. Notice, normally, you've got the desert here, you've got the Mediterranean here. Normally, they were taken captive into Egypt or taken north unto Babylonia, into Babylon. The idea of coming from the east and west is global in scope. Literally, from around the world, they're going to be gathered back. Thus saith Jehovah Sabaoth, let your hands be strong. Encourage yourself. Don't get weak on me. Quit frowning. You that hear these here in these days, these words by the mouth of the prophets, which were in that day, the foundation of the house of the Lord of hosts was laid. Others, hey, you guys were here. You've seen the temple foundation being relayed. You've seen what's going on. Let this be an encouragement to you. For before these days, there was no hire for man, no hire for beast. In other words, the economy was shot. There was no work to be found. Neither was there any peace to him that went out or came in because of the affliction. In other words, they had defunded the police. The streets weren't safe. There was no business. There was no safety. For I set all men, everyone against his neighbor. This was judgment. By the way, we're facing it now. But now I will not be unto the residue, the remnant of this people, as I have treated you over the last 70 years. For the seed shall be prosperous. The economy is going to come back around. The vine shall give her fruit. And the ground shall give her increase. And the heavens shall give their due. And I will cause the remnant of this people to possess all these things. And it shall come to pass that as you were at one time a curse among the Gentiles. O house of Judah and house of Israel. Notice, do you see any lost tribes here? Okay, thank you. So I will save you, and you shall be a blessing. Don't be afraid. In fact, be encouraged. Let your hands be strong. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, as I thought to punish you, hey, when you disobeyed me, in fact, I told you at Mount Sinai, I told you at Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, if you disobeyed me, I was gonna paddle you. Well, I did. But now I'm changing my actions towards you just as I said I would. So again, I thought in these days to do well unto Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. Don't be afraid. Now again, he repeats what we covered in the last chapter. For there are things that you shall do. Here's what I want you to do, just like Micah said. Be honest with each other. Speak ye every man truth to his neighbor. By the way, this is 24/7 Christianity. Execute judgment, justice of truth and peace in your gates. Let none of you imagine evil in your hearts against his neighbor. Love no false oath. Don't lie to each other. Don't misrepresent something in a business transaction. For all these things are things that I hate, saith the Lord. By the way, these are the gates of Dan, that ancient city I mentioned. These were the outer gates of the city, obviously going up a hill. Inside here is an area where the elders of the city would sit. Out here would literally be the business center, like a mall. You would have temporary tabernacles set up out here during the course of the day. And then in the gates of the city, there would be just judgment. You look right here, this is where the king would sit. Around here, the elders would sit. So when it talks about, I want justice in the gates of the city, that means in your business and in your courts. By the way, you just saw the word violence a moment ago. Understand that we don't understand fully what that word means. When God judged the earth and flooded it in the days of Noah, he made this observation. He saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And God said unto Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them in the earth. That word violence we saw in our study of Jeremiah. Violence spews forth out of Jerusalem. She casteth out her wickedness. What do you mean, Jeremiah? Violence and spoil. Notice those are synonyms. Violence and spoil is heard in here before me continually is grief and wounds. We think of violence as in physical violence, as in being physically assaulted. But you can see the Hebrew word Hamas literally means falseness, injustice, damage done. And notice in the Strong's down here, or actually the International Bible Encyclopedia, violence includes actions motivated through hatred or greed. Greed motivated the rich and powerful to exploit the powerless, robbing them of their rightful property. Can anybody say World Economic Forum? Amos condemned the wealthy leaders of Samaria for storing up violence and robbery in their strongholds. Various proverbs warn against the following path of these who enrich themselves, not through hard work and frugality and commerce and free market, but who enrich themselves by exploiting others. So that word violence means more than just you running the risk of being robbed physically as with a gun in a back alley. But you can be robbed economically any other way by deceit. Word of the Lord of hosts came unto me, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the fast of the first. So more fast, these that you have set aside, those are going to be turned into times of feasting. Your fasting is going to be turned into feasting, is what God is saying. Of course, as we come in for a landing, remember when Jesus was preaching at Nazareth. He was given the scroll. Their Bible reading for that day was Isaiah 61. Jesus would have stood at the pulpit in the middle of the synagogue. He had had seats all around him. And he would have stood to read the scripture. Then he would have rolled it up and sat down to teach, which was the custom. Jesus said this as he read Isaiah 61, or what we know as Isaiah 61. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because the Lord hath anointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek. He hath sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, the opening of the prison to them that are in bondage, and to proclaim that it is now time to accept the Lord. Luke tells us that at that point, he rolled up the scroll and gave it to the head of the synagogue and then sat down, as was the custom to teach then. All the eyes of them in the synagogue were fixed on him, and he began to say unto them, "Today, this messianic prophecy is fulfilled right before your very eyes." Now, get this. He stopped in mid-sentence. In Isaiah, there's not a period. It continues. "And the day of vengeance of our God." This is first coming. This is Zechariah 9:9. This is second coming at Armageddon. 7 years of tribulation, then the millennial reign of Christ. "I'm going to replace your fasting with feasting. Comfort all that mourn, to appoint unto them that mourn in Zion, to give unto them beauty in place of the ashes, the oil of joy in place of mourning, the garment of praise in place of the spirit of heaviness, that they might be called trees of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that God might be glorified. And they shall build up the old wastes, they shall raise up the former desolations, they shall repair the ancient cities and the desolations of many generations." Again, I would say that we are seeing that, the Ezekiel 36 being fulfilled right now in the next stage, of course, rapture, 7 years of tribulation, then the millennial reign. Verse 20, and we're done. Verse 23, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, it shall come to pass that there shall come people and inhabitants in these many cities. And the inhabitants of one city," oh, this is good, "shall go to another saying, hey, let us go quickly to pray before the Lord in Jerusalem, to seek the Lord of hosts. I will go also." Now notice that this is beyond just the borders of Israel at this point. "Yea, many people and many numbers of strong Gentiles," that's what the word nations is, "shall come to seek the Lord of hosts in Jerusalem, and to pray before the Lord." We're going to see this in detail in Zechariah 14. By the way, you can find it in every other book of prophecy as well. The Jews, the nation of Israel is to be God's lighthouse to the world, drawing the Gentile world to the one true God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the Jews were to be a kingdom of priests to the world. And they will be. "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 Gentiles are going to accompany one Jew back to the Temple Mount, taking by the prayer shawl, saying, 'We will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you.'" All right, chapter 7 and 8. Next week we pick up in chapter 9, where we get into the really fun stuff. Again, you hear me reference Zechariah 9:9, the prophecy of the first coming. Where, how are you going to recognize the Messiah? Well, here's how you're going to recognize him. He's going to come humbly riding into Jerusalem on a donkey's colt over the top of the Mount of Olives. And that's exactly how he made his triumphal entry. So next week, we really get into some of the fun stuff. But that gets us through chapters 7 and 8.